Well, then I can make a comment about if they don't know what the picture is.
Exactly, yeah.
And if you have any question about it, I'm going to add to it we go along.
We'd love to, okay?
And
after
panel.
Thank you.
And just want to let you know what the digital cost thing I'm doing at 3:30, we're going to announce the third game of the show.
Cool.
It's going to be cool. There's no details, but I want to let you know.
Thanks.
When they ask me, I'll know. Yeah.
Oh, you're setting up.
You set me up? Great.
You're in LA?
I am, in fact, I live just less than a mile from the Skirball, so it's a nice area, yeah. And not too far from where Jerry Siegel lived, actually, when he was out in the Brentwood area. Right. So, yeah. What about you? Are you in California?
I'm in New York.
New York, so. How long have you been out this time?
Oh, we just arrived Wednesday, yesterday.
Yeah?
Yesterday.
Do you spend any time out here after the show? Or?
I will. My son lives just south of LA in Palos Verdes.
Yeah.
So,
yes,
I think I met him, his son here, right?
Yeah.
Him a minute ago, yeah.
So we'll be spending some time with him.
That's nice.
Some business in LA.
I know Mark Evanier is the gentleman who normally handles this sort of thing, but I'm the guy who knows just this much less than Mark about comics, so if it's okay with you, I don't...
Oh, that's great. Mark has done several.
Yeah.
Anyone else want to take a picture? Let's get it over with before. He's a legend.
I do them with paper cups, too.
While we're waiting, while we're waiting for the PowerPoint presentation to be set up, let me just make a brief introduction because it's such an honor for me. My name is Mark Wade. That's not the honor part. Very kind. Thank you. And I'm, frankly, unlike most of the times when you see me on these panels, I'm actually a little uncharacteristically nervous because this is quite an honor. I get to sit here to this gentleman to my right, who began working for Bob Kane back in the earliest days of the Batman strip and development, and really very quickly put his own creative stamp on that character as well as some of the other Batman characters that we'll talk about. He went on from there to become a world-celebrated cartoonist and whose work has been seen internationally by millions of people. He has been a champion of creators' rights, working for Siegel and Shuster over the years to help them regain their interest in Superman. And currently he has an exhibit at the Skirball Center in Los Angeles, which I highly recommend that you see. You've been behind that, and it's been a great setup up there. We'll talk more about that as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jerry Robinson. So we're going to do this as hand shadows and hand pump for the next hour. While he's setting this up, if we can talk a little bit about you grew up in New York.
No, I grew up in Trenton, New Jersey.
That's already a bad start. There you go. So you grew up in Trenton, New Jersey, and you went to journalism school at Columbia, right?
Right.
And this is, so at what age did you realize that this is, that cartooning is something you really wanted to do?
I guess it was my first paycheck.
Let's grab your microphone over here, actually. Let's see here. All right. Tell me about your first paycheck. I'm serious. Tell me about, what's the first time that somebody paid you to do this for a living and you thought, hey, this could be a good gig?
Well, it's not even worth mentioning. It was so small.
But it's not about the money. The idea that... So now you've gone from drawing on the back of craft paper and drawing on sidewalks to actually making your first sale. Do you remember what your first sale was?
Well, it was Batman. So it was all about money. I was just a student, and I just thought of drawing when I had the offer to start on Batman, of earning my way through college. And that was my incentive to draw. Yeah. And I also wanted to write, of course, studying journalism. That was my goal. So when I found I could write and draw, that was wonderful. So I was able to do both.
Yeah.
I started on Batman the first year of Batman, 1939, and I was 17. And so here we are.
Well, tell us the story about how you and Bob Kane first met, because it's actually a really good story.
Well, I guess I have to go back a little bit. That summer I graduated high school, I sold ice cream on the back of a little wagon that you tow on a bicycle. That's how ancient this was. And so I spent the summer. Is this working well enough? Can you hear?
A little closer.
That better?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I sold ice cream all summer, and I was down to, well, not all summer, good half of it. I was on the 98-pound track team at the time, and played tennis as my sport, and I was down to about 78 pounds, I think, after peddling ice cream the hot summer. So my mother insisted that I take $25 from the hard-earned money I made. I think I got 2 cents, a popsicle or something. And added up to the $25 a week at a resort to fatten up, because she thought I'd never last through the first semester of college. And it took a lot of popsicles at 2 cents for it to add up to $25, so I wasn't anxious to do it, but I finally did. And the first day there, I went to a mountain resort. I think it was the Poconos at the time, in New York and New Jersey. And I wore a painter's jacket that we had used in high school. It was kind of the fad in college at the time. And so it was a white linen jacket, an actual painter's jacket, that we decorated with drawings and the graffiti at the time. And I used it as a warm-up jacket. So when I went out to the tennis court, I put on that jacket and was looking for a partner. And I feel a tapping on my shoulder, and somebody said, "Who did those drawings?" I had drawings all over the back. I thought I was going to be arrested or something. And he said, "Oh, they're pretty good." And Ronnie introduced himself. It was Bob Kane. The first issue of Batman had just come out, and I guess he was taking a few days vacation. I luckily wound up at that place. And so we got to know each other. I had never heard of Batman. It just came out, of course. So he took me down to the local store, sold magazine newspapers, and showed me the first issue of Batman. And frankly, I wasn't terribly impressed. I was used to Liv Terry the Pirates and Hal Foster and Prince Valiant in the newspapers. And but when he said, "Well, you need an assistant on Batman," and I said, "Well, I had applied to Syracuse, Penn, and Columbia for journalism. And luckily I was accepted in the three, and I couldn't decide where to go, and I decided to go to Syracuse, only because it sounded more like a college town, and New York and Philadelphia didn't. So I said, "Well," he said, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm just about to enter Syracuse, study journalism." "No, too bad," he said. If you're in New York, I need somebody to join the Batman team." It was just Bill Finger and himself. So I quickly ran to the phone and called Columbia to see if my application was still good. And luckily it was. And I ran to call Syracuse and told them I wasn't coming. And then I called home and said I wasn't coming home. And I took the, I got to New York.
Well,
strange
that,
way
that,
to get
this.
To
I love, if I may, you know, I love this story. This is something that I didn't know about you until I heard you talk at the Skirball Center. So explain how you just happened to catch a ride home to New York.
Yeah. So I was supposed to go to New York. I think I was only in New York once in my life when I was very young, so I did not get there. And I went asked at the desk, hotel desk, how do I get to New York? It was very convoluted. I had to take a couple of different buses and change and whatnot. So he said, "Well, if you go to New York City," what's his name now? It was the leading tenor of the Metropolitan Opera, was singing at that resort that weekend, and he was going back to New York. I'll
Caruso.
Think of his name in a moment.
Wasn't Caruso, was it? Or is it
no. Anyway.
This is a much better story when I could remember who's what the name of the gentleman was.
Yeah, me too.
Tibbet?
No, it wasn't. But,
you're
trying.
You're a son. You know this.
I know.
No.
Domingo.
Before Domingo.
Let's just say Placido Domingo. Let's just say that, and then it's a much better story now. Okay.
So he said, "Well, Domingo was just about to drive back to New York. And he said, maybe he'll give you a ride. He said, you'll ask. So I timidly went up to him and said, Mr. Domingo, whoever you are, is it possible to get a ride? And he said, oh, sure. And so out comes this huge limousine with a private chauffeur, and he'll hop in. And that's how I entered New York. He kicked me out in the Bronx. Fortunately, I had an aunt lived in New York, and so I was able to spend the first full nights there until I found a room, which was just a few blocks from where Bob lived, and that's how we got started with cartoons. So I was first started my classes at Columbia and working at night, and later I switched, because that became tough to do, and I started going to classes at night, and just the opposite.
So who was around you at this point? It was Bob, it was Bill Finger, it was you, and that was it, right?
It was Bob, Bill, and myself.
Yeah.
And Bill, of course, as you know, was the greatest comics writer of the time, and still is. He should have been listed as co-creator of Sigmund and Schuster.
Yeah.
He created all the other major characters. The one I contributed was the Joker, as you know. He did the Penguin, the Riddler, Batman, everything. And he wrote all the first stories. Met in Gotham City.
Came up with the whole origin, I believe, with the parents and the shooting in the alley, and all, which is, you know, all the quintessential Batman mythos material.
He was a very modest, unassuming guy, and was probably that was fault because he didn't assert himself to get the rights that he deserved. But we became very good friends. He kind of took me under his wing. He became my cultural mentor, as it were. Coming being in New York, I knew nothing but the subway from the Bronx to my room to Columbia University and back again. And so he took me to the Metropolitan Museum, MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. He took me all the foreign film where to keep them out at the time. And so it was great. He was very well read. He really read everything, from classics to pulp magazines. And he was able to contribute so much to as Chris says, to the mythos of Batman.
But the character was still very much in an embryonic stage, and there was no sidekick yet, there was no arch villain yet. So let's talk about how you came to play in that role. Robin and Joker were created roughly about the same time.
Robin came first, and then Joker, yeah. But very close to each other.
Yeah.
Yes.
And my understanding is that you had more than a hand in creating both those characters. We talk about that a little bit.
Well, Robin, I think Bill was the one who thought that a boy should be added to the strip for story purposes, and gave a chance for Batman to talk to someone. To go out on his adventures with Batman, got in trouble with Robin, would help save him, and vice versa. So it enlarged the potential of the story. So in talking about the story, of course, the first thing we had to do when we decided to add the boy, everybody agreed that was a great idea. We had to name him, and names are very important in the comics. And so I think we had about a list of 30 different names to choose from, and we kicked them around. And nobody was happy about any of them. And a lot of them were kind of superhero kind of origins, like Mercury or some, which was common at the time. And I felt, that strongly it shouldn't have any superhero connotations. Because I think the thing that we thought best about Batman, that he was an ordinary guy. He wasn't a Superman. He didn't possess superpowers. And I felt that the boy should reflect that. And so in seeking a name, I suggested Robin. And Robin came from not Robinson, which I wouldn't have been so presumptuous to name character. But it came in the character Robin Hood. And Robin Hood, I was given a book. I was given two books that were very important in my career and my thinking. One was Robin Hood, The Adventures of Robin, and the other was The Complete Stories of Edgar Allan Poe. And I can talk about that later. But I still have both of those volumes. I was given them about, I was about 10 or 12 years old. Because I always say how important an impression good literature stories can make on somebody very young. And so when I was thinking of the name, Robin came to mind because I had read those Adventures of Robin Hood, you know, dozens of times. I knew every illustration in the book, and the book that I was given was a very handsome book at the time. I think it's a graduation present. And it had all the illustrations of N.C. Wyatt. N.C. Wyatt was a great painter and illustrator, and the grandson of the current Wyatts, of the whole family of great painters. And N.C. Wyatt, and I so admired those illustrations. I knew every one of them. And so when I thought of Batman, I thought of the N.C. Wyatt, I mean of Robin, I thought of the N.C. Wyatt illustrations of Robin Hood. And so I quickly sketched out from memory the Robin Hood costume that N.C. Wyatt had first painted and drew for the illustrated book. So that was the origin of the costume as well as the name.
But you still needed, the strip was still missing one important thing, and we had, by that time, Batman had his modus operandi, he had his sidekick, he had all the, he had many of the toys, but he didn't have the great arch nemesis. He didn't have the true arch villain. So was this something where the need for a villain sort of came up first and then the Joker came to fill it, or was it just a character that you that grew on, had took on a life of his own, or what?
Well, I'll recount the fateful night.
Exactly, please.
I said I was still a student at Columbia, and we got word Batman was starting to really get popular. And I think it was only out about 6 months, less than a year. And so we got word that they were contemplating putting out a whole issue of Batman, which became Batman number one. It had been appearing in Detective Comics a month ago. And so it's just one story a month needed. Now, Bill was a great writer, as I said, but he wasn't that prolific. Writing, he took very great pains. He was a very good craftsman. And to do something that, well, particularly at the time, it was a new medium. We were inventing a new way of storytelling as we went. You know, the whole genre had no past, and it was only a present and the future. So we had to invent things as we went along. And so suddenly Bill was confronted, we all were, with doing five stories in the space of the time we were only used to doing one. Four stories for the new Batman quarterly and one story for the Detective Comics.
And if I may, here, the prep time here, I would guess, would be very, very brief, because if you look on the cover of Detective Comics number 38, which is the first Robin story, is a very iconic Robin, introducing Robin to the world cover. But the very next cover to the very next Detective Comics is basically a scene from the Joker story. Mm-hmm. It's Robin on the end of a big long flagpole, and the Joker's chopping away at the flagpole, and Batman's trying to stop it. So clearly, all this material was originally intended. The covers were prepared enough in advance, but the material was clearly intended for Detective Comics. And then at some point late in the game, I would think the publishers decided, you know what, we need Batman in his own book. So I would imagine you probably didn't have, it's not like you had months and months to prepare this material. This was pretty on the seat of the pants.
They actually took those pages right from my hands.
Yeah.
And so they did, as you say, very, very quickly.
Yeah.
They did the four stories. So we had a conference and said, how are we going to get this out? So I volunteered to do one story for the new quarterly.
Right.
And Well, Bob and Bill were delighted. They knew my writing. I showed them my writing from Columbia, and they knew my aspirations to be a writer. So they were delighted that they now only had a 2-3 for the New Portland. So they said, fine. So I went home that night to my little room in the Bronx and took out my breadboard that I drew on, leaning against the table, and started to think about my story, or what I hope would be my story. Well, at that time, I went back. Remember, I was a product of the 20s and 30s. This is a time that the villains in life were the Dillingers, the Pretty Boy Floyd, Machine Gun Kelly, Bonnie and Clyde. They were all bank robbers, embezzlers, and so forth. There were very few villains in the comics. There weren't. Sometimes, once in a while, we had a mad scientist. That was about it. And so when I sat down to write my story, that's the premise I started with, that I wanted to do a big, important villain. It would be the key to it. Because I knew that from my studies at Columbia and my readings of literature, all great heroes had a protagonist. In the Bible, from Goliath all the way up to Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty, and all the great villains in between. So that was my idea to create the villain. And kind of presumptuous of me, but when you're young, you think big. I guess trying to recount the whole thing, and actually I'm writing my memoirs now, and I had to try to remember all those things in sequence. So I think that, I know the first thing was to write, the villain was going to be the important thing in my story. It was to be a big villain, but not another bank robber and that sort of thing. I wanted somebody that was kind of came out of literature, from my readings of Poe and all the other great writers who wrote mysteries, stories. And the short story form was my the one I liked best, and the things that I was writing in Columbia were short stories, mostly satire and humor, and some humor twist in. And so that was part of my thinking also. And then it clicked in. And I knew that every great villain, not just villain, every great character has something contradictory in his, a contradiction in terms of his character. So that would make him memorable. So a villain with a sense of humor would be different. You don't think of a villain with a sense of humor. So that was the thing that started me off in thinking of humor, and I thought of humor naturally because that's what I was writing mostly. And once I got onto that track, as I said before, names are very important. And I thought if I can get a name up front that I could settle on, that would help flesh out the character in my mind. And so once I thought of the villain with a sense of humor and thinking of the names, I thought of the Joker. Now, why did I think of the damn Joker? Because kind of everything in your life turns up somehow. In my family, there were a lot of expert card players. And one brother was a champion contract bridge player. It's like a champion chess player where you've got master points, he had bridge points. And once he won 17 tournaments in a row. So he was in fact he graduated Yale Law at 23, so he was the brain of the family. So, and then my mother was a very good player, not a champion player, but she was pretty good. And I played so. So, but cards were in the family, so I think that was once I thought of the Joker,
right.
I thought of the Joker playing her. And I remember literally searching my room for a deck of cards to get the Joker in front of me to reinforce the image. And luckily I did. And it had one of the classic clown jester images.
Man, I'm glad your family wasn't into chess instead, or that worked out well.
Yeah, the villain would be the bishop today.
So, to finish
that one last thing. So I got the playing card and did my first concept sketch of the Joker right away, and then I started doing other sketches of him, that first sketch had apparently stuffed in the back of a drawer somewhere after we did the first story, and it survived. And when I first curated that story, the exhibition is now at the Skirbo Museum in LA, we found for that exhibition.
Yeah.
So the original drawing is in that, so that survived, luckily. And
I love that part of the story. I love that was, again, when I saw the exhibition, that was one of the highlights of the, that was one of the highlight pieces.
Yeah. The image, quick as that.
Yeah.
I think the image of the Joker, when I sketched out the figure, which unfortunately that doesn't exist, but I thought that's where the Poe volume came in. Yes, that volume was illustrated by Harry Clark, an English illustrator. I didn't know them when I was a kid, 13, but I was impressed just with the color of the drawing, and I related to the Wyeth drawings. So I guess I was always kind of influenced by art and was aware of it. And so I thought of those Harry Clark drawings, and they were all kind of very elongated, mysterious figures.
This is interesting. I've never heard you talk about, and that's one of the things I want to talk about. I've never heard you talk about your influences like this. I've never heard you mention this. This is very interesting. So,
interviewed me, and I recalled that probe.
Interesting. Yeah. Were there other? I mean, not to get too far off track, but say, were there other illustrators whose work you looked to at that? Because you had such a distinctive style early on yourself, and such a polished style so early on, as opposed to a lot of the guys in comics who were just. Or aping, you know, Roy Crane, or aping some of the other.
No, I never knew about Crane at all. Although I did learn him later, and I got to know Roy, who was a wonderful guy, and wonderful artist. I think the illustrators were those were the only two. The other ones I think were an influence. Were Hal Foster and Milton Caniff.
Yeah.
Because I saw those in the newspapers, and I admired their work.
Right.
And I think those were probably the greatest artistic influences.
So at this point, it's the three of you guys working on Batman. George Russo sort of come on at some point.
So he came maybe a year or so later. We got an office in the Times building, one little room.
Yeah.
In Times Square, on the top floor. We could look down on Times Square. It was a great, great office. And we hired George to assist me.
Right.
Up until that time, in addition to whatever penciling I was able to fit in to do, I did all the inking, figures and background, and even the lettering. You know that little R that's on Robin's? When I designed the costume, I added that R as a counterpoint to Batman's bat on his chest.
Now, so at what point, I know you were with the Kane Studio, you worked directly for Bob for 2 years, 3 years?
No, only about a year.
Only about a year, okay.
And Bill and I left
for
various reasons.
Well, to work directly at DC at National?
Well, we were going to leave.
Right.
We had got offers from all the other major publishers. Because everybody wanted somebody who had something to do with the great success of Batman.
Right.
And there were just three of us. So Bob would have me already. So we were the person the office heard about us.
Yeah.
I mean, they had never seen us.
Yeah.
We were unknown quantity. And so when they heard, finally it leaked around, they heard about it. And both Bill and I were wined and dined by various publishers. Busy Arnold was one quality publisher. He gave me a great offer. I guess I was ripe old age of 18 by that time, and he offered me a job to edit all his books, do a new lead feature of my own, and that would be great. So I was torn between that, and then when Batman heard about it, they made me a new offer to stay with Batman, and so ultimately, on the promise that I could do my own stories and covers, I stayed with DC.
Interesting. Was that, now were you working in a bullpen situation there as well?
Yeah.
You're working at the National offices?
Before that, I'd worked at home, and then we had the office for maybe a year at the Times building. And they hired, when DC hired us, we were directly in the bullpen. So that's where I got to know Siegel and Schuster very well, Joe worked right next to me. On the other side of me was Jack Kirby. The next one was Mort Meskin. And next was George Russo's was like back of me. Oh, Fred Ray was also one or two famous. And we were, you know, as close to each other as these tables are. And so we got to know each other pretty well.
Yeah. Well,
and it was a great, I think, bullpen at that time.
Well, on a creative level, I mean, clearly you made your biggest connection probably with Mort Meskin of that group of gentlemen. So what kind of a fellow was Mr. Meskin?
Well, Mort was one of the few who had studied art formally. He went to graduate of Pratt Institute.
Yeah.
He was some years older than me. But I got to know Mort through one of my closest friends was, which you probably don't know, artwork was Bernie Klein. He did a few features for a few years, and he was from my hometown. And when he had heard I had made it in Batman, he sought me out and asked what to do to break in the field. And I told him sample paint. So I just met him one night at a party, and he told him what to do. And he said, when you finish, come see me in New York.
Yeah.
And I'll
send Placido Domingo around with a limousine to pick you up. All right.
And he worked on the loading dock of the Trenton Times, the paper, loading paper. And he drew cartoons for the paper, sports cartoons, for $5 each. But he showed me those samples of these. And I saw he was quite good. And so I thought he could make it. I told him what to do. And then I just met him that one time at a party and forgot about it. And then a month or two later, I get a call from him, and he said, Bernie Klein. Oh, Bernie, yeah. So we made a tape to have lunch, and dinner, or whatever it was. And he had gone home that night. In fact, it was a New Year's Eve party. That's what happened to be in my hometown. And he went home after that party, worked up samples all that day, all that night, and the next day. He was so excited about what to do to get a job in New York. And he came in on his own, went down to this one publisher called MLJ.
Right. It became Archie Comics later on, right? Yeah.
And so he didn't call me until he was already settled and had a job. And so once we got together, we made a lot in common aside from my hometown friend. And so we got an apartment together that we later, Mort Meskin joined us.
Right.
So there were three of us in this apartment. So that became kind of a hangout for our cartoonists of DC Comics. Little Jerry and Joe would drop by, and Herbie, Simon, and Fred Ray, we became a good friend. And
were these your swinging bachelor days?
Yes. Sorry, girl.
Sorry.
This is my dear wife, girl. Who also came to New York in a different way. She's Norwegian and lived through the war in Oslo under the Germans, and she was an editor for the Oslo paper and got a leave of absence to study in America and went to Kent State for a year and then transferred to Columbia where I was, but we didn't meet there. We met at a swinging village party.
Well, next year I'm interviewing you. That's fascinating. So now you're working at National now, and that was not that long a period of time. You'd like to roughly like the mid 40s, I would say, or
I worked there until about 46, 47.
Yeah.
Then I left because, well, I had drawn Batman so long already,
right?
And so I wanted to do something more. Although I did Moonlight, as we called it.
Yeah.
Did things rather. Publishers while doing Batman under my own name or that I could write and draw. And but finally I wanted to make a break.
Yeah.
So I did strike out. And
was there a specific, do you remember a specific moment where you thought, or was it just a general sort of, I realize it's not quite the path that I wanted to follow? And
well, I think it was more that I began to get so much other work on the outside.
Right.
Moonlight that I could write and draw myself and have more freedom than doing the same thing in Batman. So I think it's a question of I had enough offers for work that I was able to leave.
And you, but your comics career really sort of tapered off as your newspaper career really started to take hold, right?
Well, I continued in the comics until about 1960.
Right.
I worked very closely with Stan Lee for 10 years.
Sure.
At Timely, where we did all sorts of things, from Western, romance, crime, science fiction, which is what I liked, because each month I would usually do something different. And after the repetition of all the years just drawing one character, this was fun for me.
Yeah.
Then I did a couple other features for the publishing. Did the Batman, Bat Masterson, which we licensed from the TV series.
Right.
What's his name? Gene Barry.
Yeah.
And I did that. I enjoyed doing the Westerns. That was kind of fun to do. But they also licensed Lassie. And somewhere in your career, you do a lot of things to pay the rent.
I can imagine
Lassie was one of them.
I can imagine this would not be terribly creatively fulfilling for any great length of time. So
I learned to really hate that dog. And I endured it for a couple of years.
Well, and then, go ahead, I'm sorry, please.
Well, I did a lot of other strips, and Morton Musk and I became partners. We had our own studio, and we did The Vigilante, Johnny Quick, Fighting Yank, Black Terror, and then Simon Kirby had their own studio, and we did a lot of work with them as well.
And then at some point, I mean, did you always stay close with Mr. Meskin, because even though your partnership, you're actually working together, that kind of tapered off in the early 60s as well, right?
Yeah, well, then I ended up to do a newspaper show.
Right, and that's what I wanted, and that was really the next major
then
phase.
Then I began a teaching career also, and at the same time, the School of Visual Arts.
Right.
My greatest claim to fame, I guess, is that Steve Ditko was my student.
I would.
Among some other
By the way, you've been doing a yeoman's job trying to get this PowerPoint presentation working. Oh. We really appreciate it.
Is it working?
Sadly, no. But luckily, you're a colorful enough speaker where it doesn't seem to be an issue. So
you're fired. You know?
My next job is to try and get the disc out so I can give it back to you.
That would be helpful too.
Yeah. That's going to be your last job.
Is anybody here a Mac Weenie by any chance?
I'm in a room full of comic book people. There must be somebody who worked in the AV squad when they were in high school. Come on.
Maybe you can.
Oh, man. All right, here we go. Well, let's talk about your newspaper career a little bit, obviously, because that was, as much as we like to hear about the comics end of it, that this clearly, is where you really made your mark on the world is through the newspaper work. So,
well, I did a first big job in the newspaper was to do a science fiction strip called Jet Scott, and if I can give a plug, Dark Horse is going to republish the whole 2 years of Jet Scott. I just finished designing the book and stuff. And that was fun. I think it was some incredible work I did at Jet Scott. That was a couple of years in the 50s.
Yeah.
And what I really wanted to do for a long time was to be a political cartoonist. I'd always been a political animal. My mother was active in local politics. I can even remember the race between, when I was only a few years old, between Roosevelt and Hoover. I think my mother was a committee woman.
Interesting.
And
she had the political bug from way early on.
Yeah, yeah. And I always loved politics. I read it avidly. Yeah. And so my first opportunity was 1961. I presented an idea to the New York Daily News Syndicate. It was a Tribune News Syndicate, Chicago Tribune News Syndicate. And I wanted to do, again, something different there, because at that time there were no op-ed pages, just one page of editorial page with editorials and the paper's editorial cartoons. Today we have only op-ed page made up of columns and other cartoons. That didn't exist. So to do an editorial cartoon that was sitting in, I had to do something different because the paper wouldn't run two editorial cartoons. So I wanted to do a political commentary or satire. So I invented a concept of where there weren't any characters, there were just objects. And I was able to do it in the panel. And so there were just objects that commented on the news. For example, one of the continuing characters were a paper basket and a fire hydrant in the corner. And the paper basket was very well informed because the daily paper would be thrown the paper. So he knew politics, and he talked politics to the fire hydrant. And from there it went on to other objects under the sun. I did it about 17 years of different objects, 6 days a week. And they were political commentary. And that was sold on the editorial pages, but it was at the bottom of the page, and it was in a panel and just objects. So it didn't look like an editorial cartoon. So then the editors would buy it, so it wasn't a competition of their own cartoon. But I commented on the same current events. Well, after 17 years or so, papers then, by that time, had developed, expanded to op-ed pages,
right,
where there was more room for the editorial cartoons, more editorial cartoons. So then I changed it, instead of being called Still Life, which, by the way, was my wife's creation of the name.
Next year, we're interviewing you.
And which was very magical, because if you think about it, I came up with all kinds of names. There was nothing that described, wouldn't say inanimate objects, that's a hell of a title. And so Still Life did it perfectly. You know, still in life, and they're just still like objects, etc. And I invented a style to go with that. But when that became unnecessary, I changed it to Life with Robinson, became a horizontal panel, and appeared in editorial pages. And I did that for another 17 years, about 32 years all told, one every day.
That's very impressive. That's amazing. And were you still working in the States, or were you traveling, right?
I traveled a lot. Yeah. And one summer, our whole family went on a whole summer, and I had a studio in back of the car, and every week I'd stop somewhere and do six cartoons, and continue on.
I am horrified by the fact that this is what you get for being such a great raconteur. Is apparently we are almost out of time, but there's a million other things I want to tackle here.
It's still not work.
Wait, yeah, they're gonna crack it like a piggy bank if they have to. I promise. So,
I had some good examples of all this stuff.
Luckily, I would guess that most of these people are quite familiar with your work, which is great. And again, I apologize for the. For the, not these gentlemen's fault, the, for the PowerPoint not working.
Anyway, we're at the same time next year.
Well, we still got a couple of minutes, and there's still, one of the things, there's so much left to cover that we didn't get a chance to cover, like your involvement with Siegel and Shuster and your involvement with other syndicates and so forth. One of the things I did want to talk specifically about, though, that's going on right now is again the exhibit at the Skirball Center. If you could talk just a little bit about what that's about, and because it runs through August 9th there, just, you know, a couple of hours north on the 405, well, depending upon what time of day, but yeah. But if you're in the LA area and you can check it out, it's a wonderful exhibition.
It's right near the Getty Museum, right off the highway. It's on the hill opposite Getty. You see one from the other. Well, that came about, I got a call from the director of the Brevin Museum in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah.
He said they were thinking of doing an exhibition on the comics. Would I be interested?
Yeah.
Well, I had curated a lot of exhibitions I had brought around the world on American cartoon art, but I never did one just on the so-called golden age of the comics.
Right.
And so that interested me. Anyway, to make a story short, I tried to do that. And we spent over 2 years to put that exhibition together.
Yeah.
And they hired the top designer of Coca-Cola in Atlanta for their shows, Coca-Cola traveling shows, to design the show that would travel. And he did a beautiful job. And in that exhibition, I had a lot of the earlier things that I had done that I fortunately had saved, some of Simon and Kirby, and some of Joe Shuster, and all the early Fred Ray's classic.
Is it a very impressive show? I just saw it with my friend.
It's a very impressive show.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
My apologies that we are... I'm being told that we're out of time when we could have gone on for another hour easily. I apologize that we didn't leave room for answering questions.
He's going to be on another panel in an hour.
Then save your questions for another hour, and this is great. So you get another panel in an hour.
This is
great. Roommate in an hour. Mr. Robinson will be there with the others. All right, terrific. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.